Welcome back to another edition of the Unofficial Guide Disney Dish Podcast with Jim Hill. It's Len Testa, and we're back on this chilly winter morning to give you the warmth that is stories from Jim Hill. Welcome back, Jim.
Oh, hello, Len.
It was like that. It was not the Jack London novel that I was trying to pitch, where Jim and I are huddled underneath a single solitary tree in the middle of the winter outback with only two sticks and a match between us.
That's right. Thank goodness we have this pile of 2013 unofficial guides to keep on the fire.
Exactly. Oh, wait, that's the Kindle edition. All we have is bits. All we have is digital media.
All right.
So. Well, in this edition of the show, Jim had a great idea for this show. It was instead of tracing the history of a particular attraction or the history of a particular park, we're going to trace the history of a particular building and tell you how the use of that building has evolved over the years and what Disney has done with it. And we're going to start with, I think, one of the buildings that has seen the most change since the Magic Kingdom opened. And that's the Fantasyland Theater, which is currently the host of what, Jim?
Mickey's PhilharMagic.
But it hasn't always been Mickey's PhilharMagic. This is before my time. What did it start off as?
Well, back in the day, we're talking when the park opened in October of 71, this was the Mickey Mouse Revue, which, you know, if you saw, you know, or you can go on YouTube and watch it, that the opening day or the opening special for Walt Disney World, a 90-minute thing that ran on NBC, they give about 10 minutes of the special to Mickey Mouse Revue because it was one of the more stunning attractions of the park at that point. I mean, you're talking about 73 different audio animatronic characters performing numbers from classic Disney films. And, in fact, one of the real ironies of this whole situation is that when they were putting together the park and they were running ideas by Roy Disney, Bill Justice had put together sort of a little cardboard theater, and you know they were queuing up the music on LPs, you know, just off to the side. And the presentation ends, and Roy says, "That's exactly what we should be doing at Walt Disney World. Walt would have loved that." And
really?
Yeah. In fact, there's an interesting interview with Walt in December of 1962 in Newsweek, where he's talking up the Tiki Room, which will be opening in like 6 or 7 months. And, you know, and while the amazing stuff he can do with audio animatronics and looking to the future, he says, you know, someday, you know, I want to do something with all the Disney characters. I have in mind a theater, and the characters will not only be doing a show, but they'll be sitting in a box with the guests, and they'll be heckling the people on stage. And Walt ends with, "I don't know how I'm going to do that, but I'm really looking forward to it."
No idea this is actually going to happen, but man, it's going to be awesome when it's done.
Yeah. So in a weird sort of way, this is something that Walt wanted to do, you know, almost a decade before Disney World opens, and Roy signs off on it immediately. And then it gets kind of interesting from a back of the house situation, because you're going to need a tremendous amount of computer power to pull off this many audio animatronic figures on stage. And Bill Justice was actually doing double duty. He was helping design the Hall of Presidents and the Mickey Mouse Revue. Eventually went to the guys and said, "Well, look, wouldn't it make sense if they sort of shared a computer room?" So actually, if you ever see the flyovers of the Magic Kingdom, this kind of one giant building that straddles Liberty Square and Fantasyland, and that's Hall of Presidents and Mickey, or the Fantasyland Theater. They're basically done back-to-back, so down, you know, in the bowels, down with the utilidors, there's a common computer room. Well, you know, and the funny thing is that, of course, when they were initially wiring the place, there were a couple of times where, you know, the people would be in the Hall of Presidents room and go, "Okay, fire it up." And it's like, and here comes the Mickey Mouse Revue audio coming through. And it's like, no, go tell them to toggle the other switch.
Thomas Jefferson singing.
Abraham Lincoln singing Three Cavaliers is a wonderful moment, but, you know, sadly.
Not a lot of people know, but that was actually the opening act to the Gettysburg Address. Everyone thinks the Gettysburg Address was only like 3 minutes long. It turns out there was this whole 10-minute prelude to it.
Oh, very sad.
So when you walked in the building, was the setup to the Mickey Mouse Review the same as for Mickey's PhilharMagic? Did you go through a sort of a longer queue, end up at a little holding area, and then walk into the theater? What was it like?
Well, actually, it's interesting you mentioned little holding area, because this was one of the things that really kind of bit the show in the ass. That and again was a planning mistake that Disney learned and never did again. They built a 500 seat theater, and then it came time, you know, so they throw the park open in early September and start bringing in, you know, the families of the construction workers and that sort of thing, just to get a sense of, all right, you know, how much time, you know, are they in the queue, and, you know, how do we load the theater, and getting the mechanics out of the way. And so the nice person with the hand clicker there, you know, standing there with the fire marshal, and they begin to realize that the pre-show room, while the theater holds 500, the pre-show room can only fit 300.
but the pavement in Fantasyland.
yeah.
It can hold a lot, really.
And it was one of these things where they tried, you know, like, okay, so we have this many in the room, and then we'll run the other people in the queue, and they could never make it work, which meant that this – from day one,
60% capacity.
60% capacity. And in fact,
we tried cattle prods. We tried everything.
You know, and it was this was on opening day. This was an e-ticket. And now, again, you have to understand, Disney never does this, but because of that snafu and because of guest complaints about, well, you know, how popular could this show be? I'm sitting in a half-empty theater. Disney actually downgraded the show to a D ticket in 73.
Really? E to D? Yeah. Wow.
You know, just to the notion of this will make the guest complaints go away. Because, again, you bought a book, you had an E ticket, you spent the E ticket, and, you know, you figure, I'm at the super popular attraction, which I could play handball in because there's nobody here. You know?
Wow.
So kind of sad. And so now we jump ahead to late 70s. Disney is talking with the Oriental Land Company about doing Tokyo Disneyland.
Right.
And, you know, the Oriental Land Company at that point wasn't really into innovation. You know, they would just tour the Disney theme parks. They'd go to Florida. They'd go to California. Okay, we want that. You know, it's like, well, oh, you want to ride like that? No, I want that.
Yeah. Like, you know, they're at a department store saying, no, I don't want a dress like this or a shirt. I want this shirt.
Yeah. And so that's basically how that park was built. In fact, you know, honestly, for opening day, they had one, you know, attraction that was really their own, the Meet the World thing. And even then, that was supposed to have pulled double duty at the Japanese Pavilion at Epcot, except for that, you know, that slight bugaboo about Pearl Harbor. You know,
one minor international military incident.
which the show stepped around. Do you ever hear how Meet the World deals with Pearl Harbor?
Is it how they skip from like the mid 1930s to the mid 1950s pretty quickly?
At warp speed. In fact, that what they do is that they reach the point where the Japanese is militarizing. The theater goes black, and you hear like a kaboom, you know, and it's like, you know. And now, you know, we have learned from the lessons of the past. And now, and, you know, just they go into modern Japan and how happy we are. And, you know, please disregard the 1941 to 1945. And I'm sure nothing of significance happened during that period. But, hey, look at the singing crane, you know.
It's like how Carousel of Progress completely skips over the 60s in Vietnam.
There you
go. Oh, that? Nah, interesting things to talk about.
So, you know, but again, that was supposed to, I mean, they built the building. They were ready to throw that show in to the Japanese Pavilion. And they did a couple of presentations in California to, you know, groups that they recruited from the VFW, you know, and I was like, that really didn't go well. You know, so. Anyway,
I can see the guest surveys were nothing but the sentence, "You weren't there, man! You weren't there!"
Pretty much. All right, so
the Orlando Land Company comes over and says, we want one of those. Disney World is probably looking at this going, hey, you know, we're running this thing at 60% of capacity. We could do some stuff here.
That's it, exactly. So they pack it up and send it over,
sale.
You know, send it overseas. Right. And so this is, you know, it closes down in September of 1980, opens up in Japan of April of 83. But in the meantime, you know, it's like, okay, we got this big theater and, you know, they show animated cartoons in a while. They occasionally show films in there for the cast members, but it's a really, it's a big empty hole. You know, in their lineup for quite some time.
Okay.
Now, all right, jump ahead. It's October 1st, 1982. Magic Journeys opens at Epcot.
Magic Journeys. Okay.
And by the way, Led, I've uncovered some stuff that I know you of all people will dearly love. I mean, do you know anything about the guy who actually put together the documentary, the initial documentary for Magic Journeys?
No.
Okay, the gentleman's name was Murray Lerner, and again, the modern Disney company would have never gone for this, but this guy, if you go and if you're looking for the definitive documentaries on Jethro Tull, The Who, Jimi Hendrix, Bob Dylan.
It's him?
This is the guy. This
really?
Is, you know, and it was one of these things where evidently when they were looking to do – you know, a slightly trippy thing, and you know, well, who do we get? And you want
Murray? Get Murray.
Get Murray.
What's his name?
Murray Lerner. That's L-E-R.
You're right. The stuff like Bob Dylan, a bunch of
yeah. I mean, you know, so it,
Wikipedia calls him an experimental film director. You know what that means?
There you go. There you go.
Stuff.
So you know, just. You know, it makes me regret that, you know, that's when I saw that film, like, I was too young to have been properly medicated, I guess. but anyway, to jump ahead. So that, again, that park opens in 82. You know, and meanwhile, who comes through the door in October of 84? But Michael Eisner. And Epcot at this point is, its attendance is falling in a large way. And they know that they need to do things to get it to bump up attendance. So that's immediately when they begin thinking, okay, could we do another 3D film, and which turns into Captain EO? Mm-hmm. But again, this is Disney. You know, you don't spend that much money on a product, you know, and just make it go away. So Magic Journeys, actually in December of 87, moves from Epcot over to the Magic Kingdom and starts being shown in the Fantasyland Theater. And, you know, and that it hangs in there for, you know, almost 7 years. You
so
know,
Magic Journeys was only at Epcot for 5 years?
Yeah. I mean,
wow. Okay. All right. All right. Okay.
Well, like, I mean, you gotta figure when EO came in, I mean, they had to shut down the theater for about 3 or 4 months put in the lasers, that sort of thing. So it's probably even less than 5 years. I mean, just played the 4 years, goes over to the Kingdom.
Wow, okay.
Now, where this really, really gets interesting, and this is kind of a turning point in Disney history, is 94. And okay. This is the year of the Lion King, which a lot of ways, this is the first time that the modern Disney company decided, okay, we've got a movie that we're pretty certain is going to be a smash hit. So let's really get it out there. And so what was fascinating is you had on the West Coast, you had the Lion King Celebration Parade actually opening 3 weeks before the movie. I mean, it was just one of these things. They did this massive parade that was tied just to this film.
Mm-hmm.
And then, which, to be fair, 2 years earlier, they had done the Aladdin's Royal Caravan, which had been very popular. But they'd never done a double, sort of a double pump before, where they did a parade on one coast. And here at Walt Disney World, they basically gut the theater and put in this giant puppet-based, about 25-minute-long version of the film that did all of the big songs and that sort of thing. Legend of the Lion King. Now,
and so they started work on that before the film came out.
Yeah, I mean,
wow.
So it all hits at the same time. So when you go to Walt Disney World, you know, I mean, 3 days after the movie opens, you can go to Fantasyland and go into the theater and see this amazing stage show, you know, with full size. I mean, you know, that some of these puppets were so huge. For example, the Simba, mm-hmm, in this thing required 5 people to operate. Wow. In fact, I know you really love the multimedia stuff that we can do sometimes. I'm going to suggest now that folks go over to YouTube and type in Legend of the Lion King backstage or behind the scenes. There is this amazing video that one of the cast members shot during the run of the show, where you're literally down in the trenches with the puppeteers, and you can see how these puppet rigs are the equivalent of harnesses that people slip over their shoulders. And
oh, I see. Legend of the Lion. So the thing to Google or YouTube is Legend of the Lion King behind the scenes, and the title is Legend of the Lion King Pit. It's the video. It's the video from the, wow, look at that. And you're right, cast member only. Yeah.
There you go. And, you know, I mean, some of these puppets, you know, from the audience, it was hard to get a sense of scale. Some of them are as tall as 6 feet or 8 feet
long.
Oh,
this is a great video. Oh, this is fantastic. Yeah, some of these things are huge.
Yeah. But you get this real, and you get to see this sense of choreography of how hard these people had to work to stay out of each other's way, you know,
and perform the show. It's like complicated square dancing. I mean, look at that. That's the video's pretty. The other interesting thing about it is, number one, yeah, the rigs that these people are wearing, they're essentially wearing like shoulder harnesses.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
To distribute the weight of some of these puppets, and some of these puppets are just massive, and also everyone's dancing along with the music too, which is really kind of funny.
Now,
wow, that's a great video. Good job.
Yeah, and now this show actually builds on the Voyage of the Little Mermaid show. In fact, Fran Schroeder, the woman who directed Legend of the Lion King, directed that show as well. And there was just this, between the money they spent to redo the theater. I mean, it's a giant set for this thing. It's 125 feet wide. That coupled with the fact
it's got trenches too. It's got different layers, so it's not just like one big open area. They've got the initial stage, then they've got like a wall with more scenery, then it looks like they've got another wall with more scenery. So you could have 3 different levels of puppets in 3 different areas of the pit.
And
okay.
And I mean, it's just the scale of the. I mean, yeah. And by the way, the. You know, the trademark Disney name for these puppets is Humanimal. All right?
That's
the Humanimals, but okay. You know. And, again, so the show runs for 6 years. It runs from July of 87 to December of 93. Mm-hmm. That's December of 87 through December of 93. Magic Journeys. Mm-hmm. This one continues at the Lion King, Legend of the Lion King continues at that theater from July of 94 through February of 2002. And now, again, with all of these sort of representing what's going on within the Disney company at this point, I mean, here you see, you know, with Legend of the Lion King, you see the Michael Eisner notion of synergy, that we're going to double down. Lion King's going to be everywhere, and, you know, we're going to make big, big dough off of it, and it was a smart move. Jump ahead to 2002, and this is Michael Eisner looking at the fact that, you know, the traditionally animated films that the company are doing aren't really doing the business that they used to do.
Mm-hmm.
Coupled with the fact that, you know, here's the rise of Pixar, and, you know, it's doing the CG films very, very well. And Disney has this whole library of characters that are hand-drawn and, frankly, are starting to look, you know, kind of passe because the Pixar stuff is so hot. And so have this conversation about, well, is there a way that we could perhaps do our classic characters in CG, and so that this almost becomes a science project at Walt Disney Imagineering, because that they're both Walt Disney Imagineering working with Walt Disney Feature Animation, because, you know, one of the things that makes Disney Animation work so well is squash and stretch. And, you know, was squash and stretch, in fact, even possible through CG?
Yeah.
So, by the way, just one quick side note here before we totally leave Legend of the Lion King. It's worth noting that, again, you were talking about the size of these puppets and, you know, how an audience would sit there for 25 minutes and watch this. Supposedly, Michael Eisner came up with the idea of the Broadway stage version of The Lion King by attending the Walt Disney World show.
I can totally see that. Looking at the pit performance video from on YouTube, I can totally see how one leads to the other. Because that's the first thing I thought of when I saw the video. Like, you know, this looks like a Broadway stage show.
Yeah, and you know, but 4 years later, you know, there it is in New York. So, you know, the key difference being that, you know, at that point, I think a Broadway theater ticket was actually cheaper than going to Walt Disney World.
Oh, geez, really?
There you go. Well, I think it was $60. you know, in fact, right now, the Lion King, a ticket to the Lion King, if you're talking about the Argus or decent seats, it's $120 to $135.
Really?
And we'll probably go higher when Aladdin opens in March in New York, because, of course, that'll then be the default. It's like, I'd love to get you in Aladdin, but I can't, it's sold out. So, hey, you want to go to the Lion King? So, all right. Anyway, and the other thing, just keep in mind here, you know, that one final thing about these puppeteers. Keep in mind, these kids are doing 3 shows an hour. All right.
Yeah, they're doing like 30 shows a day.
16 hours a day. So, yeah, at the height, when the park was open the longest, that supposedly there were days when they do 65 shows.
Wow.
Which, again, to me is just astounding. And, I sat there and I couldn't work the math for that. But it was just like, I was talking with a cast member. Said, yeah, personal best was 65 shows. So I think that may have been one of the
65 shows.
So from what I understand, it was one of those nights where they were doing a corporate buyout. It wasn't a corporate buyout. It was a night of joy.
Oh,
so, I just can't wait. To go to the chiropractor and to dig this rig out of my back. So, anyway, getting back to Mickey's PhilharMagic. The other thing that's fascinating about Mickey's PhilharMagic is one of the things that they were looking to do is this is the modern Disney company, that this is removing the Eisner-Iger era. And the whole notion was you don't build a standalone attraction. You build something that you could clone for other parts of the world. So, and they were already looking at building Hong Kong Disneyland. And the problem was that, you know, a lot of the Disney characters, you know, have very, you know, don't translate well. You know, I mean, when you're doing, I mean, you've got the character voice department, you're doing the best match you can, but, you know, it just doesn't work overseas. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why they picked Donald basically as the host of the show, because the nice thing about Donald is he's incomprehensible in whatever language you want to use. So it's like, I don't understand him, but, you know, you don't understand him, Hong Kong, we don't understand him, U.S., we have a commonality here. So,
just like us, we don't understand.
Yeah,
that's funny.
So. They shut down the Legend of the Lion King. By the way, if any of you folks have actually been over to Paris to see the Animagic show there, actually a couple of the puppets did make it into that show. So again, Disney recycling. But now you've got, and the other reason, and this is what's also kind of fascinating about why Mickey's, you know, Legend of Lion King was replaced by Mickey's PhilharMagic. In July of 2001, there was kind of a coup d'etat at Walt Disney Imagineering. Marty Sklar, who'd basically been in charge of Imagineering for 20 years or so, had been pushed aside. And the gentleman who replaced him, Tom Fitzgerald, had been the vice president at Imagineering of what was known as theme park productions. Theme park productions, if anything involved film at Disney theme parks, Theme Park Productions made it. We're talking about the Circle Vision shows. We're talking about, you know, the film elements for Hall of Presidents. You know, if you're the safety video, you watch it on the monitor going in. That was Theme Park Productions.
Really? Even the, yep. the safety videos?
Okay. Yep.
Okay. And, anything on film. Got it.
All right. And so here's Tom coming through the door, and Tom's starting to green light projects. And so what does he do when they're looking to redo you know, the Fantasyland Theater? It's like, we're going to put a movie in there. And but it's not going to be just any movie. I mean, he wanted to do, you know, we're going to take everything that we've done up until this point and just push it. We're talking about, you know, the smellizers. We're going to talk about, you know, extending the screen. In fact, that's another thing about Mickey's PhilharMagic that's frankly fascinating to me. All right, you've got, you know, 160 degrees widescreen in there. I mean, you know, they do that illusion of, you know, you come in, you have the relatively small, you know, proscenium stage.
To start, yeah. But yeah, then during the Lion King segment, it gets bigger.
It gets huge. I mean, it's 150 feet long. It's 28 feet high. But the interesting thing is how they pull off the 3D effect is that it's only 3D in the center of the screen. That there's
really?
A setup. Yeah. On the extended part of the screens, you know, where they push out to the outermost edges, that's flat. In fact, what they did is they did some tests with it to determine, you know, whether or not they could do the 3D image out, you know, the 150 screen. And what they found is that it really distracted people. It took them away from the central action and actually was causing people to be nauseous. And so it's like, all right, let's just do 3D at the dead center of the screen, and the other stuff will be colorful off to the side. And, you know, they cut it back to that. And, you know, it began to work. But at the same time, this was very much an R&D project. Nobody had ever done, you know, characters like Donald Mickey in 3D. In fact, one of the reasons why Mickey just basically runs in is they really couldn't get a handle on how to do his ears in 3D. So he's deliberately blurry because they couldn't figure out, you know, how do we pull that off in perspective? I mean, they had to actually wait till Mickey Mouse Clubhouse when they finally figured out how to do that. But at the same time, you know, George Scribner, the director of this thing, he had a challenge in that he had to figure out how to create this world where and the other underlying agenda with this project is because they wanted to be sure that the Beauty and the Beast characters, Aladdin, Little Mermaid, would have a life beyond their 2D films. They had to figure out how to make these characters into CG. So the production of this thing took 3 years, if you can believe it. 12-minute long film, 3 years. And they at some points they got so stymied about how to do these characters, they actually brought back in the two-dimensional animators. I mean, for example, when you see Lumiere in the movie, Lumiere is actually animated by Nick Ranieri, the very same gentleman who animated Lumiere for, you know, the 1990, you know, 2D version of Beauty and the Beast. And in fact, where it gets even more interesting is that they could not make Ariel work. I mean, it was one of these things where they were doing the Little Mermaid scene, and it was just laying there. It was like a dead fish.
Really?
All right. You know, the scene just would not work. And so they call in Glenn Keane. And, you know, Glenn, of course, the Michelangelo of animation. I mean, the legendary Disney animator. And he came in and reboarded everything. And this was what actually he, you know, this was sort of his hands-on for computer animation. And he liked it so much that when it came time to do Rapunzel, or as it eventually became known, Tangled, it's like, oh, we got to do computer. I love this stuff now. Okay. And which brings us to the final little interesting bit about, you know, Mickey's PhilharMagic. I mean, you know, obviously been a huge success. In fact, you know, the irony of of this whole situation, Lynn, is it was so successful, it actually bumped out when it came time for Tokyo, which it had, you know, again, it had had the Mickey Mouse Review since 1983. When it came time to let's upgrade the show, let's redo the show, no, to hell with it. Let's go with Mickey's PhilharMagic.
There you go.
So, you know, it just it replaced, you know, that show went east as well. But we're now.
Really?
So
Japan is like, okay, we'll take it.
No, that's it exactly. It was one of the things came over. It was they loved what they saw, and you know the whole notion of it meant that they didn't have to keep a maintenance team, you know, working on the Mickey figures. You know, I mean, that,
sure.
I mean, that's the other problem with people didn't understand about Mickey's, you know, the Mickey Mouse Review. You know, you had your central figure, you had Mickey Mouse. All right, this thing was 42 inches tall, Len. All right, and at the day it opened, this figure was as complicated, could do as many moves as the Abraham Lincoln figure.
In wow.
Now think about it. You've got 33 different functions. Abraham Lincoln is six feet tall.
Mickey Mouse is half that.
Yeah, 42 inches, all right?
3.5 feet.
So he was this constant maintenance nightmare, you know, just keeping that figure up and running. So when the Japanese saw that, you know, what, you hit a switch and it goes on? Yes, we want that. Though, another weird little bend on the story that, so that attraction shuts down, you know, a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
The Japanese pull all the AA figures out of the theater. And it's at this point the Imagineers go, excuse me, you know, could we have the three Caballeros figures? You know,
I see where this is going.
Yeah. And the whole notion was after the fact.
Wait, so they take it out of Japan and they put it in the Mexico Pavilion?
They're actually still backstage right now in bubble wrap. This is, in fact, kind of a sad commentary on modern Disney company. There is basically this financial push and shove going on right now. What they initially wanted to do was bring in the audio animatronic three Caballeros figures and put them in the finale room. So you know how you come and you arrive at the concert and there's that kind of the Hollywood Bowl setup that you're looking into
screen. Yeah.
Well, the notion is you enter the room, and here are audio-animatronic, host Jose and Panchito and Donald. But the problem is that, again, every theme park has, you know, at Disney is its own little duchy. And the vice president who's in charge of the park then decides, how am I going to spend my money annually? And so, you know, here they've been shipped over. They're sitting backstage. All they need is the money to install them.
Oh, it's not being prioritized.
Yeah, and the whole notion is the vice president that's been in place at that park for a while now is like, how much is that going to cost? And, you know, basically it's like I can build how many more little individual restaurant pavilions for food and wine, you know, which I can then recycle for flower and garden. Versus spending the money to put Donald and Panchita and, you know, Jose in. And so, you know, we're talking about 5 years of sitting backstage in bubble wrap.
That's amazing.
Well, but again, it's...
I mean, I get it from, one thing costs money, the other thing makes money. I get it. You know, it's just the idea that, you know, somebody had to pull it out. They had to ship it all the way, you know, halfway around the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've got to, and it's just been sitting there, you know, when you think that somebody somewhere else might be able to use it. Yeah, that's probably why. Yeah, that's probably a consequence of Disney running each theme park separately.
Yeah, it is. It is. So, but meantime, doubling back on what they did for Mickey's PhilharMagic, again, if you actually take a step backwards, I mean, some of the effects, for example, the stuff that made the show so innovative have actually been pulled. I mean, for example, there was a moment during the A Whole New World number where when Jasmine came on screen, and don't ask me, you know, again, it's just the whole notion of a whiff of Jasmine was released from the little thing in front of your seat, which it turns out a lot of people are allergic to Jasmine. So,
oh, yeah, because they don't do that anymore.
Yeah, so that's gone. So likewise, there used to be a little squirt of water when Flounder was there, that, you know, a number of the the sort of in-theater, in-your-face effects have gone. I think they still do the scent of apple pie, but...
They do apple pie. They still do a, I thought they still do the spritz of water when Donald gets drenched in the Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Okay, okay. Thing. So, but,
interesting.
Yeah, but again, the whole notion was that, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's done in there. In fact, even The Lion King, you know, was the first time that they used sort of surround sound inside of a theater show at the parks, and really, you know, got this big response. So, you know, when they went to go do Mickey's PhilharMagic, they actually do traveling sound where, you know, you can, when Goofy is running around trying to find Donald, that sounds, you can hear his footsteps moving through the theater. But anyway, now to jump ahead, we're now here in 2013, and, you know, it's this is a company, you know, under Iger that really, honestly, you know, in fact, Iger just did a story for Forbes yesterday.
Really?
About, in fact, this is the one where they broke the news. I think you and I talked about this earlier, but they are, in fact, developing a Broadway stage version of Frozen. That, in fact, when I was interviewing Bobby and Kirsten Lopez, the folks who wrote the music, they wrote 30 songs for that show. There's a lot of stuff that they can use to sort of bump out the borders of that story. But this is now, if you go from Tangled to Wreck-It Ralph to Frozen, which in the next couple of days will officially blow by The Lion King's domestic box office.
Wow.
Now, mind you, that's 1994 money. And if you were really going to best
it, steak cost a nickel, but okay.
Yeah, there you go. it's Lion King made $311 million domestic. In order to do in 2013, 2014 dollars, they'd have to make a $478 million domestic, which doesn't look like it's going to happen. But nobody at Disney wants to talk about that. They just want to talk about the fact that Frozen is this monstrous hit, which is why they are looking to do an update of Mickey's PhilharMagic. And among the ideas that is being considered is, you know, do we take out a couple of numbers and, you know, for example, have Donald, you know, interact with Elsa, you know, while she's doing Let It Go? Do we, you know, have him show up at the tavern for Tangled and be in the middle of the I Have a Dream number? I mean, what makes it different now is they have all of these digital files for these characters. It's not like in 2013 when you had to build all these rigs. You had to figure out how to do squash and stretch. They have these assets. They plug this in relatively quickly. And so the question is, if they're going to do this, when are they going to do this, and how are they going to do this? So my understanding, there's been a meeting or two with George Scribner, the original director of the film. And but at the same time, looping back to just what we talk about with Three Caballeros, it's the whole notion of, okay, so who's going to pay for this? You know, is the money to do these new inserts, you know, do Hong Kong and Walt Disney World and Tokyo all agree to chip in a little dough to do this? Or, you know, just thinking very long term here, and this gives you some idea of how Disney works these days, do we just wait till, you know, the Brazil park becomes a reality and make them pay for it? And then everybody else gets to use this.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, first
person buys a bus, second person buys a token.
There we go.
That's what it is. Oh, you want to ride? You got to buy a bus. Oh, you want to ride? That's 50 cents.
But, you know, the real irony of this is that...
It's the stupidest funding model I've ever heard.
But, you know, the nice thing is that Disney was actually... Disney Imagineering, you know, and they don't like... Or feature animation is so grateful that Imagineering wanted to do this because all of the technology they used to make Mickey's PhilharMagic, you know, a feature animation walk back... and used to make Chicken Little. And then every film thereafter, they plussed and plussed and plussed the technology. So in a weird sort of way, there wouldn't be a Frozen today, a film of that quality, if Imagineering, if if Tom Fitzgerald, when he took over for Marty Sklar, hadn't decided to do a 3D movie that mixed the classic Disney characters with the characters from the second, you know, the second Golden Age. So, you know, in a weird sort of way, there was this wonderful bonus that we all got because Disney decided to make this attraction. So it will be interesting going forward to see if, you know, I mean, because I think the ship has sailed pretty much at this point.
Yeah.
When it comes to Shanghai, that you know, they've pretty much all the buildings are set, you know, the attractions that are going into them. And Mickey's PhilharMagic wasn't headed there. And of course, one of the reasons for that is they wanted to be sure that people who were trying to decide should I go to Shanghai, should I go to Hong Kong. It's like, I already saw that at Hong Kong. So they're trying to do all new shows over there. But yeah, it's going to be interesting to see when this new version does come puddling down the pipe. But, you know, that's right now, if you talk to anybody at Disney, they don't want to be the ones to say third golden age of animation, but they're perfectly happy when other people
say it. Exactly.
Why? Yes. You can say that. I can't, but, but yeah,
that's so.
But anyway,
that's the next rev of the attraction. It's not going to be an entirely new concept. It'll be an update.
Yeah, because again, think about it. That fits into our software age. You know,
yeah, exactly. It's an upgrade, right?
Yeah, that's it exactly. You know, just sort of that gets zipped in there, and you get to advertise. Hey, you want to see Tangled? You want to see Frozen? That's in this film now.
They could totally do a Star Tours like thing where. They could randomize which segments get played each time. So like maybe they throw a Mickey Mouse in the middle, or they throw a Donald Duck in the middle, you know. But think about it. If they have to show six segments, and they've got nine to choose from, right? That's a ton of different variations.
That's a brilliant idea, Len. I do hope that the gentleman in Imagineering who occasionally
– like 700 different versions? I mean, there's a lot they could do.
Yeah. In fact, the gentleman who say occasionally they listen in on this mostly to call me up and say, this is what you got wrong.
No, but think about it. I mean, you know, if they link the end of each segment with the beginning of other segments, you know, so it's – you know, because really it's just Donald going from scene to scene, right? I mean, they can do that in a way that you can order them any way you want.
No, I agree.
Yeah, it's not a bad idea. And this way, everyone gets a random experiment, and you can make one like really rare, mm-hmm. like the you know. So you show the Frozen, but you make Tangled really rare, so that it's special when people get it or something like that.
Though one final little interesting twist on this is that because I have you seen Get a Horse yet?
No, I haven't seen it.
All right, it's almost worth it alone to go see Frozen because of the short that's in front of it. But you have to go to a theater that's in 3D to see this. But it's this wonderful sort of black and white short that becomes in color and Mickey's off the screen and that sort of thing. Imagineering is actively looking for some place to put this in the parks. They don't like the idea of once Frozen comes out of theaters and the Blu-ray and the DVD is out there, that people aren't going to get to see this. I mean, and it's always a frustration to Imagineering when they do something that they think is really clever. I mean, have you ever seen the film Mickey's Big Break?
Mickey's Big Break. How does it go?
Well, this is the one where it's basically Mickey going to Hollywood to audition for Walt Disney. It ran for a time. It was, I want to say, a pre-show for a Mickey meet and greet over at Disney MGM Studios. Again, another thing, if you're looking for something fun to watch on YouTube, watch Mickey's Big Break, because it's all shot from Mickey's perspective. So it's I want to say it was Rob Minkoff who directed it, the director of The Lion King. But it's just, you know, in fact, you'll love this, Len, because the director that gives Mickey his big break is Mel Brooks. You know.
Genius.
So, I mean, it's just the whole notion of, you know, just that he's short. It's like, but short is good, you know, and, you know, the cameraman is Jonathan Winters. I mean, it's packed with all of these wonderful acting vignettes You know, so in fact, it starts off with Mickey in his office, and who comes in but his secretary is Angela Lansbury. So now, that definitely, if you get a chance, folks, go on YouTube, check this out. But it's one of these things that was made for the park, people loved, and then there was never a venue for it afterwards when the attraction that it's was the pre-show for went away. And so now it's kind of the same thing with Get a Horse. It's sort of like, oh, we need to find some place to put that in the parks. We don't want this to go away. And there were initially some discussions about, well, we could put it in front of Mickey's, you know, PhilharMagic. We can actually do it as a pre-show in the little, you know, that holding area. So that, you know, the interesting thing is that means you get your opera glasses beforehand. So, you know, just be aware that there are some changes. And to be honest, I wish one of the changes they were incorporating is the very thing you were talking about, Len. That's a great idea.
There you go.
But, yeah, the change is coming to this room. But, again, this is, as we've talked about this whole time, that's the thing of the Fantasyland Theater, is it seems like every 10 years there's some sort of massive change made here that sort of reflects either what's going on within the company or what's going on with pop culture. And so all I can tell you, folks, is watch this space.
Awesome. That's fantastic. I'm looking forward to it. It sounds like the next revision will be a lot of fun.
Especially if they incorporate the Len Test idea. I think
they can have it for free. I just,
there you go.
Just one of those things. I just want to see it get done. I don't care who does it. All right, Jim. Thanks very much for the show. This is great. We'll continue on this for this topic for the next couple of shows.
That'll be it.
That sounds like fun. All right, for Jim Hill, this is Len Testa. You've been listening to the Unofficial Guide Disney Dish Podcast with Jim Hill. Please go into iTunes and rate the show and tell us what other episodes you'd like to see next. For Jim, this is Len. We will see you on the next show.
Take care.